little secret. Men treat women the way women allow us to treat them. And let me let you on another little secret. We will use you up if you allow us to use you up. But guess what? When it comes time for us to make that final decision, we're going to go down the hall and marry that girl with the long dress on. That's the one we're going to take home to mama. Because there's something about the way you carry yourself and respect yourself that commands and demands respect from us. That's the way it works.
We are going to launch into some very touchy territory, but important territory to take on here today. And we just heard the voice of Lincoln University President Robert Jennings, who gave this speech to the women's convocation at Lincoln University. People like Kirsten West Savali wrote very powerful pieces around this. Others have written pieces that are defending the university president for what he said as well. And the question of women and rape and sexual assault, but more than that, just the complexity of the role of black men, black women in the world that we live in. And then we can just go down the road here, any road you want, to Johns Hopkins University, where the same issues of sexual assault are taking place and also not being dealt with. So we're going to wrestle with that in all its complexity. With us in studio is Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Associate Professor of American Studies at UMBC and co-editor of Blackberries and Redbones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair, Black Body Politics, and Africana Communities. Adam Jackson is with us, Chief Executive Officer of Leaders for a Beautiful Struggle. Joining us by phone, Dr. Eric Pritchard, who is Assistant Professor of English at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and Lincoln University alum. And Stephanie Keene, an intimate partner violence specialist and also a Lincoln University alum. And welcome to the four of you. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. So when I first saw this, I just actually went over it quickly and didn't kind of look at it, and then stopped and read through it, and then read some of the critiques, especially one I thought was exceptionally powerful that I read that was written, as I said, by Kirsten West Savali. Before I say anything, I don't want to intro anything. I'd just like to get some reactions here from the four of you about how, as community, people wrestle with this. Kimberly, can I start with you and your reactions as you heard this and read about it?
Sure. I was disturbed, and I actually reached out to a couple of colleagues at Lincoln to find out if this was, in fact, the truth. I'm hoping that maybe Dr. Jennings had been misquoted or some of his remarks misconstrued, only to find out that it was, in fact, his words. And I think what's most interesting is if this was 20 years ago, we wouldn't even be on the air having this conversation. And in many ways, I think, you know, the role of social media, the immediate access that we have to the happenings that are around us today give us the opportunity to respond to something almost immediate. And I think Dr. Jennings was operating from a particular position of thinking that he was with family and able to have this very candid conversation in ways that he thought would be beneficial to black women, but at the same time, he ended up further denigrating black women. And I think that's the most troubling of what he ended up doing, is that although he may have come from a position of feeling like this is a Thanksgiving dinner conversation that we have with each other, these very candid conversations of what's really happening in black male-female relationships, what he ended up doing is vilifying black women and putting all this onus on their bodies to be responsible for the actions of everyone else. And that becomes very problematic, especially because what we're not doing is having the other conversation, and maybe he did do some of this in the all-male convocation, but we're not having this very candid conversation to call black men on their behaviors as well, so that we can have a real dialogue and stop the blaming game.
Yeah, let me, before I turn to Adam, let me go to our two Lincoln alum who have joined us who are very involved in this as well and have deep thoughts on it. Let me first go to Dr. Pritchard.
Yes. So when I heard it, I immediately was disgusted, quite frankly. I found President Jennings' comments to be reprehensible, unethical, immoral, inaccurate. Lincoln is, even when I was a student there, what is a majority black female campus, students, faculty, and staff. I know and feel deserve better. And so I was completely outraged and also really hurt and sad as an alum of an institution that I love so much. Anyone who knows me will tell you I'm a very proud Lincoln alum, and I hope to remain so, depending upon how it is the university or the Board of Trustees chooses to deal with the situation. I think that his comments are really unfortunate. In the sense that, you know, perhaps, as some people have said, he did feel as though he could talk, you know, comfortably. But I would actually push back, you know, on the idea that, you know, even if he felt that he could do that, that there are a number of things that I found to be really problematic about the whole setup. The first is that this, you know, this event was an event for black women on the campus, black students. And, you know, to have an event that I believe, from what I'm learning, was only an hour, to have, you know, the president of the university, who was a male, stand up and speak for, 46 minutes of that hour, is in itself, I think, a problematic construction. I think then the comments and the way in which the platform was used or misused make it even more troubling and concerning. And then lastly, even to be able to feel that you can talk freely amongst people who you consider to be family and to say the things that he said, that's a family table I would not want to be at, because what he said was inaccurate, it was reprehensible, it was victim blaming, and beyond problematic.
And Stephanie Keene, my guess is, as a Lincoln alum, you've probably been to these convocations as a student.
I don't actually recall being to any all-female convocations as a student. I believe that is something that President Jennings has implemented during his time at Lincoln. So I find it problematic for that reason, for the reasons that Eric or Dr. Pritchard has noted. And also for, you know, a lot of sort of response to this issue has been, you know, that there is truth or some sort of good intent behind what Dr. Jennings was saying. And my problem with that is that he has done so much more harm than any possible good that could have come from whatever it was he was attempting to say. We know that it's hard enough for survivors to report sexual assault, as is, for many reasons, stigma attached to it, fear of retaliation from the perpetrator or perpetrators, fear of not being believed. And I feel like he has reinforced all of these things. You know, watching that video, if you are a young woman who is currently attending that university and have this experience, the feeling, the stage is already set for you to not be believed, for you to be blamed, for the questions to be asked, what were you wearing, what were you doing, why were you in his room, all of these things that are highly inappropriate and traumatizing for a survivor of sexual assault.
Adam Jackson.
Well, the things about his comments, well, first of all, they were completely ridiculous, you know, first off. But there's two things that are that kind of stuck out to me. First off, it highlights, it's just emblematic of how behind we are in this country when we talk about sexual assault, when we talk about sexism, when we talk about, you know, women issues in general. The fact that a black man could get up in a group of black women and to basically tell them, you know, you're not going to be believed at my university if you were raped. You know, that's completely problematic for several reasons. And, you know, that's just kind of, it's more of a theme in this country about how we talk about issues of sexual assault, issues with women. And secondly, when we talk, his remarks on rape, like in terms of reporting rape, to me, that's just, like, if you're in a university setting, I forget her name, the alum that was just speaking.
Oh, Stephanie Keene.
Stephanie Keene. Like Stephanie was saying, you know, if you're at a university, you're a young woman, and you've been raped and sexually assaulted, how are you supposed to report at that point? How are you supposed to talk about what happened to you at a university? So to me, it's really more, it sets the stage for how the institution is going to react. And the thing is, if you're an administrator under him, like, how do you respond to that? Like, how do you tell young women who have been victims of sexual assault? And so, moreover, it should be a call for other black men like me to actually talk more about these issues, because we're rarely called or rarely in spaces and places where we're held accountable for these types of remarks.
Right.
And so we should be talking about these things on a more broad level, so that way this type of stuff doesn't happen in this type of setting.
You know, one of the things I thought that when I was listening to, after I read the articles and read what he said, and I listened to the speech online through one of the articles, it reminded me of conversations that I may have heard at the Thanksgiving table, mm-hmm. with some older uncle talking about some stuff, and people go, "Oh, please, come on, man!" Or,
exactly.
Or whatever, you know, right, and right. They, going back and forth, and but the reality is that this wasn't a dialogue; it was a monologue.
Mm-hmm.
I think as Stephanie was pointing out, but I think that I'm going to jump into the sexual assault issue that is very serious here in America, and not in every community in our country, and how misogyny runs its world way through every culture on this planet.
Mm.
But the other issues here are some of the things that were raised in some of these pieces I read about the difficulty that it speaks to inside relations between black men and black women,
mm-hmm.
And perceptions, and the historically how that all fits into this. Because, I mean, when we look at our behaviors, whether it's as human beings individually because of what happened to us in our childhood, growing with our parents in our neighborhoods, how that molded us, history molds us too.
Absolutely.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is in a historical context, something, I think, a different kind of teaching moment. I mean, we're not going to ignore the sexual abuse part of this in this conversation, but just what it means historically and what that could contribute to a conversation about who people are and what's happening in America.
And so when you think about, I think about the work of scholars like Bell Hooks, who always speaks to, you know, dating back to slavery. And when we were finally freed as slaves, and how there was a structure in place that black men believed that we would replicate what was already in society in terms of men holding the position of power and women being subordinates, when in fact what you found is a number of black women were rebuking that, saying, "I just came out of this very tumultuous experience of slavery where I was always the subordinate. I won't return to something like that, even in a relationship with a black man." And I think what we have seen is just different iterations of those types of relationships, and what it's done is created that tension that I think exists between black men and black women in terms of their interpersonal relationships. You know, so, I mean, bell hooks go as far as saying, you know, in terms of our media representations, for our relationships, we're either, you know, fighting or effing, right? You know, it's always one extreme or the other. There isn't this cultivation of understanding each other and able to relate to each other in ways that isn't in a way contentious. And I agree with it. I think that's very much a part of our reality now. And so what we have are men who do have positions of power who seem to continue that same message that only further separates or polarizes us from each other.
And Eric Pritchard, I think I heard your voice on the phone responding. What were you thinking in this conversation, in this part of our conversation?
Regarding the question of, I'm trying to remember your initial question. I'm sorry, Mark.
But the initial question being that there is a historical context to this. And what kind of conversations does this allow to open up in that historical context to move people forward, to think about why this is being said, what the complexities are in a, I mean, I'm thinking about this piece. Let me just, there's a quote in here from her piece, one of the pieces I read. I'll just read the quote. And just to kind of look at this for just a moment before we come back to the sexual assault issue directly. It said, according to black feminists, Bell Hooks and Audre Lorde, black women have long shouldered the responsibility of protecting black men from a white supremacist, capitalist, heteropatriarchy, which in its most current configuration has barely sheathed agenda to commodify black bodies as slave labor for the prison industrial complex. Pretty powerful sentence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, I think where this comes up for me as a teachable moment is because I'm thinking of, you know, the other sort of major conversation that we've been having, you know, as a result of what has happened with Mike Brown and before Mike Brown, Jordan Davis, and before Jordan Davis, Trayvon Martin, is all of the ways in which the black body, you know, is under assault. And I think that there's been a rush, you know, by African-American people and by allies of African-American people and people who are aware, you know, of those issues to, you know, point out the ways in which they are, you know, horrible events and horrible things that are occurring. What I think has been sort of the flip side to that is that many of the people who have been on the front lines of that discussion, who have been talking about the ways in which black men in particular are affected and under that assault, have also been people who wanted to raise the issue of around rape and sexual assault, but especially around the ways in which women of color and girls are under these similar kinds of violences, and there's been a hesitancy in many ways to engage that part of the discussion. So I think as I look at, you know, President Jennings, what he has said and an opportunity that exists for us as a teachable moment is that for me it further shows, you know, the kind of the ways in which we marginalize women of color and girls in these conversations. Immediately when I began talking to other people about what it was that he said, you know, people, you know, wanted to dismiss, you know, and say like, oh, you know, he might have said this to, you know, the young man, or, well, there are women who, you know, X, Y, and Z, you know, and that there's some truth to it, you know, all kinds of things that I find to be really problematic. So I think that the teachable moment in it is an opportunity where we can say, for me, what I've been thinking about is how it is problematic to have a situation where we cannot just, you know, like, for at least a minute, just sort of focus on women of color and girls and the ways in which they are specifically affected by this particular issue that is under discussion. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with, you know, like,
right,
giving that space and that time. And I think that the comments that were made by the president exposes that we actually do need to have more of that kind of space and that kind of conversation. It's a teachable moment, learnable moment for him and for lots of other people.
Stephanie?
To add to that?
Yeah, just your quick thoughts. I'm going to get to the phones, so people are calling in and get their thoughts, but because we're going to switch this whole the idea of sexual abuse on campuses and what's happening and how we address that. But yeah, that larger thought we were talking about a moment ago. Yes, please.
I mean, I think another part of this which should be mentioned but shouldn't overshadow the issue of, you know, young women of color on college campuses and this issue of sexual assault is from President Jennings' sort of misogynistic viewpoint, a lot of stereotypes that he is also reinforcing about black men. You know, sort of the notion that these black men, these young black men who are college students, you know, focusing on their education, career-driven, but also that they are these, you know, sexual creatures that can't contain themselves and, you know, have no responsibility and no accountability in their own behaviors, right? So they're just these beasts, you know, that women are then responsible for either containing or keeping ourselves safe from.
Right.
So, you know, there's a number of things that are problematic in his message. And again, not to take away from the issue of the women who really should be the focus of this particular conversation. But, you know, he's not really particularly doing young black men any favors here either.
Right. At the same time, though, I agree with Stephanie, but I just want to mention that the reality is black women have been complicit in this process, that we continue to be comfortable in this role of protecting the black community. And so it never requires black men to step forward and actually take the same level of responsibility. And that's not to in any way to suggest or denigrate black men to say they're not doing, but it always seems to be time after time that it's black women who come to the front to do the protecting and to be that stoic individual that represents the sanctity of what the black community stands for. And that requires all of us to participate instead of believing that that should be something just on the shoulders of black women.
Yeah, what I would offer to the conversation is that when you live in a world of racism and white supremacy, the goal should be to heal. It shouldn't be adversarial. And so when you when his remarks presents black men as an adversary or someone to compete against for their attention or affection. And so what I would say is that what the message for black men should be is that we should stop being complicit in structures of oppression against black women or women in general, and that the task moving forward is that how do we create spaces where black men can talk amongst each other and create spaces for healing, as opposed to, you know, black men do this or you know, black women cause that. To me, if you're talking about the black family and the United States and in a world of white supremacy, the goal should be to heal and from the suffering that we all are subject to because of the systems of oppression that we live under in America.
I do want to get the phone, Stephanie, but I heard you about to say something.
Nope, wasn't me.
Okay. Well, I thought I heard you about to, something coming up. Okay, but you know, I think because we have to wrestle with, I'm going to go to the phones here, we have to wrestle with this question. The issue, I mean, that the Black Woman's Blueprint put out in their study, that 60% of black girls, I mean girls, young girls, experience sexual abuse before they are 18 years old. Mm-hmm. And I would say in my own anecdotal experience that 3 out of 4 women that I hear in conversations in my circles, in my world, all talk about sexual abuse that they've encountered and faced in this world. And I think that it's much more prevalent than we want to deal with and complicated, I think, by the issues you raised, Adam. But I think that this is something that I think that we have to begin to wrestle with, whether ignoring it on Johns Hopkins campus just down the road, the issues arising here at Morgan State, what this president just said at Lincoln University. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is something huge that I think we have to grapple with and put front and center.
Yeah, the presumption I think he makes in his speech is that sexual assault is not as pervasive as it is, especially for black women in American society. And so one of the things that I learned in college, I mean, or actually throughout high school, I met a lot, most of the black women that I've interacted with in my adult life have been sexually assaulted. And I didn't know, to me it was like, it was just ridiculous. I was like, that can't be the case that most of the black women I know have been sexually assaulted. And so I think what that does for black men, when you don't have those type of experiences with black women, or you don't have intimate, close relationships with black women that have been sexually assaulted, you make broad, sweeping statements that make no sense, that reinforce structures of oppression, that cause violence against women. It's like that video that was released, I think, last week, of the street harassment video of a young woman walking down the street.
Right.
And so what I heard black men saying...
Oh, in New York.
Yeah,
yeah.
New York,
right, right, right. Yes, I mean, yes.
And so what I heard black men saying, they were saying stuff like, you know, well, she, you know, it's not crazy for a woman to get yelled at in the street. I was like, well, I'm a young black man, and I can walk across campus, all across Baltimore. I never have to worry about my safety. You know, I can walk in any public place. No one's going to yell at me or say, hey, look at you, da-da-da. But most women, especially black women, you know, especially considering how their bodies are marked in society, they're always subject to that violence, no matter what, from any group of people, especially black men, most of the time in black cities like Baltimore. And so, you know, we should stop talking about how women are accountable for our actions. Mm-hmm. We should start talking about how we can heal from our own experiences and create a better environment for black women to exist in, as opposed to putting the onus on what you're wearing or what you're doing or how you're acting. It's us. We have to interact with each other. It shouldn't be black women doing all the work. We should be creating spaces for ourselves to do the work with each other.
Absolutely.
Let me open the phones here. Very powerful statements. 410-319-8888. Please join us here with your ideas and thoughts. We want to hear what you have to say in this next half an hour on the program. 410-319-8888 is the number. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. Log on to our Facebook pages. I'll be checking those in a moment. 410-319-8888. And Leo in Bolton Hill, you're on the air.
Yes. Good morning, Mark Steiner.
Good morning, Leo Burrows.
Good morning to your guests and to everyone in Radio Land. It appears to me, based on what I'm hearing, that Dr. Jennings not only uttered irresponsible comments, but it sounded as if he was pandering to those forces within the institutionalized white racist community that promotes those negative images of black men and black women. It sounds as though, you know, when we talk about a broader issue of promoting sexual promiscuity, that seems to be in the orbit of scandal, whether it be a program called Scandal or something else in our lives. We seem as a nation to promote sexual promiscuity, and we don't. We promoting child sex slavery and pornography and a lot of negatives. So I understand the black aspect of this. I can't minimize it. But when I look at what social media has been allowed to do in this country without challenge from black or white people, I'm scratching my head and saying, how come we're not going after the Federal Communication Commission, dealing with the politics of all this, aside from the morality, and holding these folks accountable as we look at an out-of-control sexual revolution in this country, which seems to say anything is okay, any kind of way you want to do it, as long as you're an adult. I don't think that should be the case. So that's my argument. It's a horrible kind of thing he said, but he's kissing behind a mark. You know, he's kind of like he wants folks to know that he wants to keep. He's the black person who wants to point the finger at other black people and say, look, they're the worst people in the society. Well, we know that white folks do, in larger numbers, sometimes the same kinds of things, whether they're rich or whether they're poor. They are just as out of control as the rest of us because we don't have the courage of our convictions to stand up for what's right anymore in this country. We've got to gain some guts.
So let me take what Leo was saying here and parse out of it. I mean, I think that, first of all, I don't think he knew he was being taped.
Social media,
right?
right.
What I saw came off of somebody's phone. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like the university was taping his conversation.
Which is why, again, I mean, I wasn't defending his stance in terms of what he chose to say during that session, but that's why I made the comment of believing that he was with family a Thanksgiving dinner conversation.
But what does it say, whether it's Larry Summers at Harvard University saying that, in another sense, that women are not as smart as men in science and math? Mm. Remember that whole thing that he did? When you have the abject reality that this kind of old patriarchy, this old way of looking at life of men and women, mm-hmm. are running the institutions that our young people are going to, and that has to be addressed. I mean, should Mr. Jennings lose his job? Dr. Jennings, I should say. Should he lose his job? What kind of response should there be to this in terms of how our universities and colleges are run? Who says what? The fact that the majority of students in our campuses now are women, not men, and black women, not black men at this moment. That we hope changes in some ways. More black men will be in college. But the reality of what we face. So we've got to take a brief break, right here. So we're going to go to break and come right back. And when we do, we'll rejoin this conversation. We are going to break here. What are we going to break? Let me hear what it is. Oh, it's Burt Williams. We're going to break with Burt Williams, who is a Hall of Fame comedian. Of course, was this preeminent black entertainer who took control of blackface. People criticized and wrestled with that a lot about who he was. And he was born this day in Nassau, Bahamas. So in 1893, we remember him with this piece. We'll be right back.
25 cents, go ahead and get something to eat. No bother.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and that's Artie Shaw, recorded this great song, St. James Infirmary, on this day in 1941, as we continue our discussion here with Stephanie Keene, intimate partner violence specialist and Lincoln University alumna, Dr. Richard Pritchard, who is assistant professor of English at University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, also a Lincoln University alumna, Adam Jackson, chief executive officer for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Associate Professor of American Studies at UMBC and co-editor of Blackberries and Redbones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair Body Politics in Africana Communities, and you at 410-319-8888. Please write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. But join us, 410-319-8888. One of the things we were talking about during the break, and I don't know if you heard the conversation, Dr. Pritchett or Stephanie Keene during the break, we were talking. This is what I posited, and then I'll let Dr. Moffitt here posit what she was positing, but that we are at a point in our culture and society where men have to deal with their sexual aggressiveness. That we, as a gender, have, whatever culture we come from, have had the dominant role and think that women are our receptacles for sexual pleasure. But now we're in a world where women are on equal footing and women are getting on par with power because the struggles are there, but on par with power. And things are changing in our society, and that's where some of the disconnect is. And I think he was talking. You were saying, Kimberly, that Dr. Jennings was actually saying that.
Yes.
In some ways, right?
Yes. But I also was arguing that his very paternalistic way of looking at sexual intimacy seemed to, again, argue the point that this was unidirectional as an experience, and it was only for men to be able to engage and
sexual
enjoy
experience.
Sex. Yes,
right.
And there was no understanding that women, too, enjoy sex, and that some of the scenarios that he offered to say you wake up the next morning regretting, well, there are a number of women who may not regret. And so to assume that it's always about the man's action and our reaction also seems problematic, because then it suggests that the man is the only one with agency or control, not recognizing the roles that women may also play in their decision making. Now, that, of course, does not get into the area of when we're talking about sexual assault, where someone is doing something with a level of power and violence towards another individual. That becomes problematic. But my argument, I was just trying to articulate the point that I think the way in which he even framed the conversation about sex and intimacy seemed to be very much about the man and had nothing to do with the woman.
And because Stephanie, let me bring you back to the conversation with Stephanie Keane, because I think that in some ways part of what discussion evolved for me in this is that it's saying it's okay that our men's heterosexual sexual aggressiveness is okay, and that some things we call rape aren't rape because I just went overboard, and it's okay. It's a new day tomorrow morning, and that is a kind of thing, a part of the unconscious subconscious push for a lot of men, and I think we have to deal with that.
Oh, absolutely, and I think it is completely a male responsibility to do that work. And that women should not continue to be held accountable for it. I also think, in line with what Kimberly was saying, is the basis of the problem of this entire speech at this convocation is that President Jennings attempted to come from the standpoint of, like, Uncle Robert instead of President Jennings. And, you know, I don't know too many black people who don't have this uncle in their family. However, you know, we don't then elect or hire him as president of a university. And, you know, I take it upon myself to be as dismissive or corrective, depending on the moment, of that uncle as I choose to, but he's not then given the responsibility of leading, you know, these black women and men into, you know, higher education. So, you know, if that is the conversation that he wishes to have with his biological nieces at home, that's problematic in itself. But that's like a personal problem. That's not him as a person in leadership. And that is the role that he needed to take, and I think it has been made clear by his statements and then by his support in the Philadelphia Inquirer of those statements after given the opportunity to reframe, and he didn't. I think he's made clear that role is not the role for him to have.
As president of Lincoln
as
University.
As president, no.
Well, I guess one thing I would add to the conversation on two different levels. One is historical context. We're talking about the relationships that men and women have in terms of power. In ancient African civilizations, with Sheikh Ant Diop in his text, Civilization or Barbarism, he was talking about, you know, how African civilizations, it wasn't how it is in American society today, where there's men on top mostly and there's women in positions on the bottom. Most of the time, the power relations were very flat. People held positions of power, like women most of the time held positions of power in the religious institutions. Men controlled the political institutions. And in terms of how we related to each other in intimate relationships, a lot of the time, you know, lineage was matrilineal. Like a lot of those things were reside to the woman. But a lot of the current contextualizations that we have of sexism and patriarchy are European creations. And so when we look at it in a historical context, we can also talk about stuff like slavery and colonialism and how white folks have brought these structures and of oppression to black folks and the black family. And so, you know, it kind of trickles down from there, like the doc talked about earlier, how it trickled down from slavery to now. And so those things are always present in how black folks interact with each other. And if we kind of jump to the next side of it in terms of how institutions work, institutions are guided by the principles of the people that are a part of it. So the way that white supremacy proliferates itself is that it imbues certain understandings of the world into the institutions and how they function. And so while his comments were disturbing and inappropriate, it's not really abnormal. Most institutions operate like how he described his perspective. The thing is, the laws that we have in place are the result of people being dissatisfied with those with the structures that exist. But most universities probably operate like that. He just said it in a speech in front of black folks.
Well, I mean, let me get some of the comments in here. I mean, because I think the conversation about what African societies were. I mean, African societies were complex, and there were lots of them.
Right.
Mm-hmm. There were tens of thousands of them. They weren't all kind of equal societies.
Right. The different variations of them. A lot of them had matrilineal lineages in terms of how their families operated. And the power operations were very different than how we look at them in
and
American
I think
society, right?
Most societies did before the church existed, before lots of things existed.
Exactly, right.
Right? We had something right maybe a few thousand years ago that we're building on that we lost in the process. But let me go to the phones here. Unless, Dr. Pritchard, you want to jump in with something?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that I think the real problem for me when I think about these comments is that it also, in many ways, re-victimizes the victims, right? Like, so it is a re-victimizing, victim-blaming speech that came from the university president. And I share Stephanie's thoughts on this in terms of, you know, when given the opportunity to, you know, take leadership and have a different kind of response, you know, he sort of advocated that and actually, like, sort of defended those initial comments. And just on yesterday, a letter came out that was sent out to the student body and then posted on the Lincoln University blog, where he apologized to the students. But, you know, when, you know, Salon, Huffington Post, you know, so many news outlets have pointed out what is problematic about it in terms of, you know, the ways in which his comments are, you know, harmful and dangerous, you know, when we're talking about rape and sexual assault, there's no mention, you know, of, you know, what he's actually apologizing for. And I think that was, you know, a missed opportunity on his part, both to, you know, learn, but also to, you know, teach. And in the conversation we're talking about, you know, the responsibility that black men have to take up, you know, if his investment, you know, is going to be in, you know, on that side of the conversation, then he should have taken that, you know, as an opportunity to begin that kind of teaching. And so I guess I want to, like, kind of go back to the idea of this all being a teachable moment. I think that in order for it to be a teachable moment, everyone has to be someone who's willing to learn. And what I find is that the comments that have been made and the responses to it just show that Dr. Jennings is not in a position to want to learn from those comments. And I don't think that this is something that looks good for a university president.
And there's another side to this argument that's not on this panel, and maybe that's our fault here, but people like Boyce Watkins takes a position, Dr. Boyce Watkins, defending the president. Mm. And I'll bring that up in a moment, but let me go to the phones here, 410-319-8888. Donna in Baltimore, you're on the air.
How you doing? An excellent show.
Thank you, Donna. Good morning.
One comment I'd like to make is we're always going to have people, men or women, who have their own views when it comes to sexuality or rape or issues of violence against women or men or whatever. Because, you know, I found, you know, in, you know, my journey in growing up, that women felt, and including women overseas, they felt that it's okay for a male to hit them, or it's not, it's okay. Rape is something that women ask for or whatever like that. And also, if we look at what Bijana Van Sant has been doing in her series of shows about, you know, men who have multiple kids, 10, 12, 13 kids, and then she digs deep in their background to find out that a lot of it was either trauma from them, you know, they suffered trauma or some issues with their own family, which is why they, you know, so we have to really start educating and putting classes and programs in schools about sexuality, about sexual assault, physical assault, sexual assault, whatever, so that, and also we need to talk about reproductive rights, because I'm finding myself always educating young women, especially African-American women, about their reproductive rights, you know, when it comes to abortion, why, you know, the history of where abortion came from, the history of why it has to stay in existence, not from a personal perspective, but from a reproductive civil rights, where you have a right to your body and not anybody telling you what to do. So, I mean, I just wanted to make that point, and mm-hmm. I'll hang up a listener and hear your guest talk, you know, comment. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Donna. And thoughts on what Donna was saying? Responses. I think that what she was raising was really important, especially I was thinking in the context of the piece I mentioned a moment ago that Dr. Boyce Watkins wrote, where he was defending Dr. Jennings. And one of the things he said in his piece, he thought that Dr. Jennings was generally trying to empower women by educating them about the ways of men, and one of them how to protect themselves from sexual assault. And also, one of the points he said, one of the dirty little secrets is that extreme feminists won't even bring to the table is that there are countless numbers of black men who have their lives ruled by false accusations every single year, which means imprisonment for black men.
Yeah, Boyce Watkins and other people like him, like Dr. Umar Johnson and other like black public intellectuals like him, when they start talking about like how, you know, their comments are supposed to protect black women, first off, black men should not rape, or men should not rape. That should be the first conversation.
Period.
Black men should not commit sexual assault.
Amen to that. Right.
That's the first thing. But then as we go down the line, you know, we start talking about, you know, what they can do to protect themselves, how can we have better conversations about it. To me, the conversation is always put back to the woman. The
That's
accountability
right.
is always put back on the woman.
That's right.
And we don't have the actual fruitful dialogue. Like I was actually saying to a friend of mine the other day, you know, as a young black man in America, I don't have spaces to really talk about what I think about women, because it's so normalized. You know, sexism is so normalized that things that are really dangerous and violent and traumatic for women are normal for me to commit, even if I don't think it's that, even if I don't think that's the case. Something that's real, something like that is street harassment.
Right.
Most men don't think that street harassment is traumatic or violent. But for the average woman, when you walk down the street and you're being harassed by men on the street, you don't know if you're unsafe. You don't know what's going to happen
right.
to you. And so for me, I can't speak to those types of experiences because I'm not a woman. And so I should be around other men like me who want to change those things about society, want to change those things in other men, and hold my friends and colleagues accountable first. So we shouldn't be talking about what women can do to da-da-da-da. We should talk about what we should be doing to stop our behavior and to control ourselves, so that way we can stop perpetuating white supremacy and sexism in America.
And we see that level of white supremacy because, I mean, again, recently the former president of GW, George Washington University, did a similar act where he put the onus back on women's bodies, where he was quoted on the Diane Rehm show of saying that women should be trained not to drink in excess so that they can be in a position to punch the guys in the nose if they mm-hmm. misbehave. Mm-hmm. Well, what about men not misbehaving?
In the first place.
right.
So there's no conversation about those actions. It's always about these things wouldn't happen if you took a different stance, and that becomes real problematic.
So, Stephanie, how do you address this in your work every day?
So, I mean, with a lot of the conversation that we've had today, is a lot of conversation that happens regularly within sexual assault agencies and domestic violence or intimate partner violence agencies. And a lot of it is just about awareness and having these conversations. one thing that, and a really important part of that, as Adam mentioned, is it's important for the statement or the conversation or the beginning of the conversation that says that men are accountable and men are responsible for making these changes to come from men. You know, I make a point in my work when facilitating these sorts of conversations and making sure that it's a male colleague that's saying these are things that we need to do. Because that's where it starts. Even as basic as, you know, men sharing with boys in their lives mm-hmm. what their thoughts are about sexual assault or intimate partner violence. You know, those are the lessons that young boys then grow up and take with them. And part of the problem is that, you know, as Adam mentioned, not having spaces to have these conversations, a lot of times silence around these issues is sort of affirming of the negative side of it, right? So if men aren't standing up and saying these things are wrong and that's how I feel about it, then their silence can be interpreted as agreeance. So I think having the conversation, you know, prioritizing, pointing out that the things that President Jennings has said are wrong over the idea of not wanting to shed bad light on this particular HBCU or other HBCUs. You know, prioritizing the life and safety of women over the reputation of said men. So I think it really is about a shift in the conversations and about a shift in the viewpoints. And making it known that women's lives and safety and health and, you know, rights are important.
One thing I would also add to the end of that, because I think his... Oh, I'm sorry.
I was going to go to Dr. Pritchard, but go ahead. Then I'll come right back to you, Adam, okay? Mm-hmm. Dr. Pritchard, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say that I think in order for that shift to happen, and thinking specifically about Lincoln University, but also I think about Johns Hopkins and the other 76 schools that are being investigated right now for basically, you know, turning their heads to instances of rape and sexual assault that have occurred on their campuses, is that you have to sort of step up and be a university president, which means that you are responsible for the care, the support, the education, but really in many ways the protection of all of your students, right? And I think to sort of, you know, stand at a platform and use that platform to speak as, you know, I'm going to be a manologist for you, right? I'm going to tell you, like, as black women, like, you know, what it is that we men do. I mean, he actually used a language that said, here's what we do, and we do this, and we mm-hmm. do that. And I mm-hmm. think that that's kind yep. of problematic
it
for
is.
A university president to do, right? Because, you know, you are standing in a position, and basically as someone who my parents and I have entrusted, you know, to take care of me and protect me as a university president, provide for me, like, a safe space in which to be educated, you know, are, you know, telling me all of these sort of, you know, horrible things that you know and using language that would suggest that you do it, right? And so I think that in order for the shift to take place, you know, one would have to, thinking of university presidents or people who are administrators in these high roles, would have to rethink, you know, how it is that they are seeing themselves, even if they're trying to, you know, speak as an insider or speak from a position of we are all family here, you know, it's a really, you know, important and delicate position, an important position to be in. And I think that for the message to have been, here's how not to get raped, as opposed to, you know, this is what we do to stop rape, is a problem.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Adam.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The only thing I was going to add to Boyce Watkins' comments about how black men are falsely accused of rape. I mean, what the most frustrating part about that argument, because there are arguments made along those lines about men's lives being destroyed because of false accusations, and the data just does not speak to that being an overwhelming trend as a theme in American society potentially. You know, in terms of black men being falsely accused of rape with white women or women in general, or being portrayed as sexual beasts, but when you look at the data does not speak to rampant, you know, false accusations. Only a small percentage of those men that are falsely accused go to jail. for long-term prison sentences. But if you look at those figures, which are, I mean, they're not nothing, but if you look at those compared to the women that are sexually assaulted, the underreported rapes, the women whose accusers don't go to jail, you know, who have to interact with them in daily life, like those numbers far outweigh anything that a lot of us are going through. And so that should be addressed on different levels. But when that argument's made, it once again shifts the focus from how we can change as men and focuses it back to how women can do things for us. And so it's one of those foundational arguments that if you're not starting and ending with how men's behavior is creating the problem, then you're not going to fix it.
Yeah.
And you know, I think that this is such a critical discussion to have, and that's why we try to have these on the show here as often as we can. I mean, I think that that men really have to we have to begin to change the way we react.
Absolutely.
and to our behavior. You know, when I was driving to our other studio the other day, I was watching this woman walk down the street, drinking a cup of coffee, and the man slowly driving next to her. I didn't hear what he was saying, obviously saying something that she didn't want to hear.
Mm.
And she looked back and tried to smile and keep walking. I heard him say, "Oh, hey," and kept talking. And then she turned the corner and he had to go straight. And I was just watching that behavior, and it was like, and as I said to my grandson sometimes, I said, you know, you may feel that way when you see a woman walk down the street, but it's your job just to keep your mouth shut. Mm-hmm. Keep it in your head and go home. Mm-hmm.
There's also a way to acknowledge the beauty.
Acknowledge the beauty without having to make it catch.
Absolutely.
But we men have so much to learn in this new world about how to behave. And I think that it behooves those of us, especially who are older, to deal with younger men, mm-hmm. and younger men like yourself, Adam, to deal with men of your generation and under, to kind of address these things.
Right, and that's where I wanted to start. I wanted to be younger than Adam's generation, because I'm thinking about the 10-year-old boy that I'm raising, that I want to be a good mate for someone.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Those
mm-hmm.
conversations have to happen now. We can't make assumptions of that sense of a rites of passage that happens for teenage boys, that they understand it or come to understand how to engage women, and then maybe we'll have other conversations as we get older. That's too late.
Too late.
We need to be having those conversations now, so that if we hear comments from our young children, that we can nip it in the bud then to talk about ways that we should be engaging each other and not making assumptions that they just get it.
We only have a few minutes left. I'd like to have Stephanie and Dr. Pritchard have some closing thoughts. Dr. Pritchard?
Yeah, I wanted to to say also, agreeing with Dr. Moffitt here, that in order to do that, we would then need to ground ourselves in the decades of anti-rape activism in text in both academic and popular venues, so that, you know, the shift that we're looking for, this conversation that we're looking for that would go from one of how to prevent themselves from being raped to one that focuses on how everyone, and particularly how men, should stop rape. In order for that to work, we have to ground ourselves. And so, you know, I would suggest to President Jennings, to any men who are listening and wondering and saying, like, how do I do that? Like, how do I begin to think about stopping rape? There was, you know, an article that was published in Ebony Magazine in 2013 by Zelina Maxwell called 5 Ways We Can Teach Men Not to Rape. And so thinking about what Dr. Moffitt just said, you know, what would be a way in which, you know, I, as an adult who has children, or I don't have children, but I have a nephew, would take that kind of information, right, and begin to think about raising, you know, my nephew, or raising my male child when I have one, to think about that. But also, I think, like, historically as well, right? Like, that we need to, like, look at the history, which is where we started. People like Joy James, people like Patricia Hill Collins, people like Danielle McGuire's recent book, people who have addressed and have a very real understanding of rape as a pandemic that continues because of the cultural, philosophical, political systems that structure and maintain that pandemic.
So, and we have to go to break here, but Stephanie, I did want to give you at least 30 seconds to have a final thought. I apologize for putting you up against the wall there.
I think more important than anything that I can necessarily say, I definitely want to make sure for anyone who is listening and has experienced rape or sexual assault, there is a 24/7 national hotline, and it's 800-656-HOPE, so 800-656-4673. In terms of Lincoln specifically, we've also started a change.org position to hold President Jennings accountable for the remarks, and to hold the university accountable for making sure that faculty and administration have proper you know, professional development in the areas of sexual assault and of intimate partner violence, so that the university can again become a safe place for people who need to report having experienced those things.
I want to thank, first of all, our two Lincoln University alum. You just heard Stephanie Keene, who's an intimate partner violence specialist, and Dr. Eric Pritchard, who is assistant professor of English at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. My dear friends here in the studio, Adam Jackson, who is chief executive officer of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Always good to have your young wisdom on this panel. Thank you so much for joining us, Adam.
Thank you very much.
And Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, who is Associate Professor of American Studies at UMBC and co-editor of Blackberries and Redbones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair, Body Politics in Africana Communities. Thank the four of you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take a very brief break. And on our way to break, we're hearing Everything is Everything by Lauryn Hill, who on this day in 1999, this piece hit Billboard Music Video Awards in Santa Monica. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Yo, we about to get